Hey Guru, everyone.
Jai Guru.
Jai Guru. And welcome to this episode of Yogananda Podcast, where we are going line by line into the autobiography of a yogi on chapter 12. And we're working our way through. We had a really interesting last part, which Priyanka is going to kindly do a short recap on. And we'll try this out. So maybe if the listeners enjoy the little recaps, we can keep doing them. But in this episode, we're going into a few main areas to discuss. The outwitting of a mosquito with a yogic trance, the overcoming of desire for destruction, and the really cool story of Sri Yukteswar, the master, and the cobra. So we're going to finish the episode really on that story. So you can read with us if you do wish to do so, and you can stop up to the last sentence of the paragraph where it says, "I have since come to realize that our divine guru is beyond fear or hurt from any creature." So do read along with this. So with that said, Priyank, take us away with a recap of the last episode.
Thank you. No Lauren today, just us no three. Today, Mike, well. Yes. So you can. It's quite difficult to get lost in this chapter because of the length of it and the various topics that they cover. But last in the last episode, it's quite a long one. We essentially talked about Sri Yukteswar's kind of existence and his minute details of how he lived his life, from his morning schedule to his meditations to his diet to his food and how he prepares his food and how he sets his examples of all the devotees in his ashram, and also his wonderful talks and satsangs. And Guruji very romantically remembered how good that was back then.
Nice. Thank you, Priyank, for that. And with that said, we will continue looking at Yogananda's experiences and some of the first time he's experiencing the various things that we're going to get into with Sri Yukteswar. So it's really lovely insights that we've got here. And the first part of it really is looking at his issues with the mosquitoes in the ashram. And Yogananda says that in the early months when he was with Sri Yukteswar, he had a very useful first lesson. And this was how to outwit a mosquito. And this is very, very close to my heart, because being in Brazil, it's full of mosquitoes as well. So Northern Ireland does not have any. And I've had my fair share of challenges with mosquitoes. So I'm fortunate to be leading this part of the chapter. It's no coincidence, I don't think.
Chris, we may have some, you know, Scandinavians or other people that have never met a mosquito. Why don't you describe what one is?
Extremely small, very hard to detect. Noisy, with a whiny type noise. It's very, very particular. I think we're hardwired actually to detect. So when one flies past your head, you immediately kind of try to jump away. Your body tries to get away with it, but they bite you and they suck up some of your blood, and that's their sustenance. So they pass diseases and things like that. They can be quite dangerous. In Brazil, you have yellow fever and dengue and things like that you need to be careful of. So
growing up in Germany, I even saw mosquitoes there, and I think it's one thing that really draws mosquitoes is like a still body of water, like a lake that is shallow, that heats up a lot in the summer, and that's like a good breeding ground. So I think in London you don't have them too much because you're roughly surrounded by the ocean, which is not a great breeding ground for mosquitoes at all.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they're rampant in Brazil. So I definitely empathize with Guruji's plight that he experienced here, that we get to see in this text. And so he was saying that in his home, and bear in mind, he came from a fairly affluent home, I would say, background. He had protective curtains at night. And this is something actually, you know, when you think about giving to charities and things like that in Africa, they talk about this, like to protect kids from the mosquitoes at night, buy them these sort of nets and protective curtains, because it's a big issue. Mm-hmm. And maybe one we in the West would take it for granted that everybody can just buy these things, but not everybody had them. And certainly Sri Yukteswar didn't have it, probably for austerity sake, not for money, but we're going to get into that. Priyak.
I love how he describes his frustration that they weren't there. He said, "I was dismayed to discover that in the Serampore Hermitage, this prudent custom was honored in the breach."
Yeah.
But I also found it quite cool. So in Mukunda's household, they used curtains. And that's obviously one good way of doing it. I remember whenever I'm in my local part of India, where they only really use them for babies. So the cots have got this like the curtain over it. It's like a permeable curtain in terms of like you can breathe, but it's like a netting that goes over the cot, and the cot that you know that sways the cool ones. But I also found it interesting how, in if you fast forward to chapter 44 with Gandhi, so this is obviously not too far from where I was, so where I'm from, and in India, and he said that when Master was visiting Gandhi when he was back in India, he said, as I was bidding the Mahatma good night, he considerately handed me a bottle of citronella oil. The Varda mosquitoes don't know a thing about ahimsa, Swamiji, he said laughingly. So I've never tried to use citronella oil, but I don't know how well that works. But that's another way that in this book they say you can outwit a mosquito, apparently.
Yeah, that's the other way to protect yourself, is using some kind of mosquito repellent. I'm guessing citronella oil is similar. What I found interesting here is that Yogananda didn't go to Sri Yukteswar and complained about the mosquitoes. Sri Yukteswar took pity on him and looked at him as like, the poor boy, look at him, he's being bitten by the mosquitoes. And then suggested the curtains. So it wasn't really Mukunda saying he's used to curtains. He could probably read his mind and probably that's what Mukunda was thinking, but at least he didn't say here that he mentioned it to Sri Yukteswar.
This also touches on something I was discussing a couple of episodes ago. You know, when Mukunda asked him to promise me that you'll reveal God to me and all these things, and he said things like, I want you to press my advantage. Then I was shocked at that kind of language. And here is the example of what I would expect. Even if he's getting absolutely massacred by mosquitoes, he's not saying a word, because you don't ask your guru for these kind of favors. So here, this is exactly a case in point, because before he was talking about essentially his self-realization, whereas here this is just a bodily discomfort. And he wouldn't go to Sri Yukteswar for that. He allows Sri Yukteswar to interject, as opposed to, you know, asking for something as mundane as bodily discomfort recovery.
Yeah, and I'm sure it would have been quite challenging for him at the time, but in reflection, he's very, you know, it's very humorous, isn't it? So he's using very humorous language. He's saying that the insects were in full residence, that he was bitten from head to foot.
Right. Is I don't know how to say this delicately, but if you go as a mosquitoes like new fresh blood, essentially. The locals don't get too bothered. I don't know if there's a chemical thing that happens where they start, you know, after you've been bitten a few hundred times, your body starts producing its own repellent in some sort of way in the bloodstream or otherwise. But anyone new that comes to town, they get absolutely massacred. And especially new people that are very well looked after or wrapped in cotton wool, perhaps in their households, that have never really experienced a mosquito, such as Mukunda, in the sense that he had nets all over the place, right? And my wife, for example, when we got married, when we came back to my family village after the wedding, she's from the village that she's from is very, very much more affluent than our one, so it's the mosquito problem isn't such a big problem, because there's no, you know, stagnant pools of water, as Mike alluded to, whereas in my village it's, you know, rampant. So that first night she got absolutely massacred. There was like red spots everywhere. And I remembered her when I read this about Mukunda as well.
I remember just now when I went to India like 10 years ago or something, I was at the ashrams, and then after dinner, people often said, like we spent the evening in the gardens nearby, and then some people said, yeah, you can use the mandir and just meditate, and it's a good opportunity. And then I remember doing that once or twice, and then just sitting there and being destroyed by the mosquitoes, because it was just really hard to focus, because they once they know you're there, then they bring your their friends, and it's just really, really difficult.
I think it's a mosquito's like dream scenario, a meditating person, isn't it? Like they can just feast without any disturbance. But the other few ways that people handle mosquitoes now, which is, I'll give you the non-ahimsa way and the ahimsa ways. So they've got these tennis rackets now. I don't know if you've seen, like basically two sets of electrical wire. So you just zap and any mosquito inside basically disappears.
Oh, wow. It's really pretty, not ahimsa.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah. And they're quite rampant in India. And so like any hotel that we would go to would have these things. And I'd be like, no, I don't want these. And then there's also these like, you get these things that plug into the wall socket that is produces this horrific fume in the air. And that detracts them as well. And my wife, instead of using that, like to use incense. Incense confuses, because they like to, I think, use sense their sense of smell to see where you are, whereas incense all over the room confuses the heck out of them. So that's a good one. And what I my personal favorite, if there isn't many in the room, I like to catch them just as they're flying like this, and then go outside and blow it out. And my wife's always amazed how I'm able to catch the mosquitoes. But
can you make a wish then when you blow?
Don't bite me.
You know, the one technique I find actually most useful is a fan. Simple as that. Just have a fan on rotate. So it's amazing because they're not very strong flyers. So that, you know, they're all over the place, and one bit of air, gust of wind, just throws them off. So yeah, definitely recommend a fan. I put it to good use. And so here we have Guruji, you know, getting sympathy from Sri Yukteswar, and he does say, you know, go buy yourself a curtain and get one for me as well. And he's making a comment to say that he's laughing here, and he's making a comment to say that if you buy only one for yourself, you know, the mosquitoes will concentrate on me. So we're going to come back to that, because Guruji makes a mental note of that comment. And really Guruji goes off very happy to comply. And on every night that he spent in the ashram, Sri Yukteswar would ask Paramahamsa Yogananda to arrange the bedtime curtain. So it was a wait and see. Is he going to instruct me to do it? Guruji didn't just go and do it himself. So very much obeying or following all the commands that Sri Yukteswar had, all the way down, let's say, to the bedtime curtains. And he's saying one night, not just one or two mosquitoes, but a whole cloud surrounded him. And we're going to get into that in the second preact. Do you want to jump in?
Yeah, and he said the master failed to issue his usual instruction. And then he doesn't actually, you know, remind him. And this again goes back to my point about how you approach a guru and what you say, what you do and don't say to him. Because this kind of, in the West, we would think this is insane. This is just such a small thing. You just ask someone, right? But I think this was also true for, you know, the monks, the early resident monks with Paramahansa Yogananda. They, you know, they didn't want to disturb him with all these minuscule things. But for us, it sounds very authoritarian, doesn't it? You can't actually ask, you can't approach a guru about something that you need, such as this. You have to wait for him to. But that's the kind of the culture. And you got to, so almost like you have to suffer. I don't know if it'll be quite a hard thing for most devotees to be in an ashram such as this, wouldn't it, with a guru such as this in this day and age, because we're so used to our comforts and getting instant solutions to our discomforts in society.
Yeah, that's a really good observation. It's not a hotel, it's an ashram where you promised you would show complete surrender. But do you guys feel that Mukunda takes it more seriously this time than in Dayananda's ashram? Because I remember with Dayananda, he complained about breakfast not being at the right time and those kind of things, right? So he seems to be handling it differently.
Which kind of touches to the whole purpose of the Dayananda episode in his life, because you might say that it was pre-training for this actual training. Because Dayananda, you know, his mundane, Dayananda already ironed out his mundane wrinkles, whereas now he's in a place with Sri Yukteswar where he can really hone in on the most important creases in his spiritual fabric.
Yeah, it definitely seems like he's, as he said in a previous previously to Sri Yukteswar, that he was going to essentially give himself entirely to the guru. So this is the manifestation of that, all the way down to this simple exercise, really, of putting up a mosquito net. And as he's saying here, he's nervous. He's got the anticipatory hum of the insects that I referenced earlier. It's probably the worst bit of the mosquitoes for me, is the noise that they make past the ears. It stops you from sleeping at times. And he jumped into bed regardless. And he's sort of, you know, one technique that we haven't mentioned so far about managing mosquitoes is a prayer. And this is what Guruji does. So he throws a preparatory prayer in the general direction. So he's trying to appease them, saying, please, you know, leave me alone. And half an hour later, he's obviously been sitting there and not saying a word. He coughs instead, pretentiously, to attract the guru's attention. And he said he thought he was going to go mad with all the bites. And so he'd been enduring all this time for 30 minutes, the singing drone of the mosquitoes as they celebrated their bloodthirsty rites. It's a great line, isn't it? Greg?
And they do celebrate. I don't know if you've actually observed a mosquito after it's had its full fill of your blood. It's like drunk. It's like it can barely fly around. It's like knocking into things, and it's basically fulfilled its like purpose for the next 3 days. You could sense their joy. So a better person may even let mosquitoes have their moment in the sun, but that's not me.
Well, yeah, the bellies are definitely filled, and they're pretty heavy. Mike.
It's a very comical scene, right?
Yeah.
Where he goes, I mean, that's just a saying, but if I could be a fly on the wall there, it would have probably been hilarious. Where he goes, and now he doesn't reply. So it's a real predicament, because I imagine this being a really difficult situation for myself. I don't know what I would do. You also don't want to look for a different place to sleep, right? But you do know you have to do something. If you just fall asleep like this, you're going to wake up with a million bites.
Maybe you were there, Mike, as one of those mosquito flies on the walls.
Yeah.
Three of us may have been there.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Part of the cloud that was swarming around.
Celebrating. It's a party tonight. Yeah, look at this guy.
Hey, we've got a lot of karma to burn, boys.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, these few paragraphs are really lighthearted, aren't they? You know, it's very easy reading, and it sort of delves into more of the real meaning behind this initial very light few paragraphs that we have here. And he's Guruji's observing then that there isn't a response from Sri Yukteswar. We're going to get into this, because this is where the real learnings come in. And Guruji approaches strict Ishwaran very cautiously says, and he noticed that he wasn't breathing. His guru was not breathing. And this, he mentions, was the first observation, close observation, he says, of the yogic trance that Sri Yukteswar was in. And I was surprised by his reaction here. He said, it filled me with fright. And I wonder what your take on this is, because, you know, Yogananda himself, we talked about this, was it just the previous episode, that he would use this technique to play with, wasn't it, his caretaker, to the point to which, you know, she was frightened, and he, you know, he came back laughing. And, you know, so the fact that Guruji here said it filled him with fright, I was a bit surprised at, Brian.
Yeah, we obviously don't know the order when he first saw this and when he then practiced that technique that we referred to last time. It could have been a couple of weeks after this, you know.
Maybe.
But the all I was going to say was that in the previous episode, Guruji mentioned that Master had stupendous, his snores were stupendous, and whenever there was a pause, then essentially this is his, he was going into his yogic trance. So then it will be quite obvious when he's not in his deep sleep, regular physical deep sleep mode, because his snoring and his heavy breathing and heavy sighing, etc., stops. So then you would start getting a bit worried, especially if he hadn't. This would probably be the first time that he saw it, that he's probably referring to, as he says, first close observation.
And I don't think he really was that familiar with this, with people in samadhi. He might have thought, oh, he died, right? And then it changes the situation completely. I don't know, like, it never happened to me with a human being, but I don't know. I remember one time when my pet rabbit died, I went to pick him up one time and he was cold and didn't move anymore. And it's just a completely different thing that now you, instead of a being, a living being, you have a dead body lying around there. So that might have caused the fright, that kind of feeling.
Yeah. And he mentions the word close, right? So he's, what I infer from that is that he probably has observed something akin to what he is observing now, but from a distance, and maybe with Sri Yukteswar sitting upright and, you know, in this yogic trance, but he's obviously not right up to him, you know, probably face to face as he is now, because we're about to see what he actually does to Sri Yukteswar in a moment. So he's obviously very close, and yeah, he could maybe feel the coolness of his skin and everything. Prick?
Yeah, and you note that during this time, the mosquito consciousness is definitely gone, because he's got bigger fish to fry. So he could have been getting bitten head to toe whilst he's doing all these investigations. But doesn't matter.
Yeah. Well, he investigates and he says that his heart must have failed. So he placed a mirror under the nose, very astute way to check the breathing. And no vapor appeared on the mirror. So he wanted to make doubly certain, and for minutes, he says, we don't know how long, but for minutes, he closed his mouth and nostrils, Sri Yukteswar's mouth and nostrils. And he was making a comment here on the coolness of the body, and, you know, it was motionless, and it sent him into a daze, and he turned probably drunkenly, you know, towards the door to summon some help. And again, you know, this reaction, I thought, well, how would I react first and foremost? And it is a different context, that if the guru is sitting in front of you, you could imagine maybe times where you're getting something read to you, there's lessons coming in, or you're meditating and then you can see the yogic trance. It's very different from going over to somebody at nighttime and they're motionless and they're not breathing. So I empathize with him, but I was still surprised that he reacted so strongly to this as I was reading through. And Sri Yukteswar, to this point, hadn't made any notion towards Yogananda, but as he was turning to leave the door, he finally speaks up and he says, you know, so a budding experimentalist, my purnose. And
the comment from Guruji is that Shrikrishwar's voice was shaking, you know, with laughter. And then Shrikrishwar said simply, you know, why don't you go to bed? You know, the whole world, and this is a great line, the whole world going to change for you. Change yourself. Be rid of the mosquito consciousness. And honestly, you could probably do a whole podcast easily just on this one line, right? Change yourself and change the world. There's so many quotes from Guruji on this, and he really took this quite seriously, right? You know, if you want to change thyself, change the world. And one of the best mantras for me is, you know, I can change. I have the will to change. I will change.
Mm.
It's that one. And often I think, you know, there's the how to change other mentality going on. And definitely, I've been guilty of having that in the past. But Guruji says himself that let your example be the way to change others' lives and reform yourself, and you will reform thousands. So, yeah, you could delve into that a lot, right? Mike, do you have a comment?
Yeah, this is a story that I read as a kid. And always found it like, you know, you then start finding fault with yourself rather than with the mosquitoes, right? But what I understood over the years is that it requires quite the advanced mind to get rid of mosquito consciousness, right? It's not something that is that easy to do. And you have to remember that you have two avatars talking to each other here. And one trying to awaken the kind of avatar consciousness in the other. I don't know if that's something that anyone could just do. Of course, anyone could just do it, but I don't think it's like the easiest thing in the world to get rid of mosquito consciousness. But it's definitely something to think about, even for yourself. And I don't want to say don't do it. I'm just saying, this might be difficult for someone. If I was in the room as well, maybe Shrikrishwar would have said, but you, Mike, you can have the curtain.
Definitely for me, that's what he would have said, because I tried to put this teaching into practice a few times. Can't say that my willpower or whatever was strong enough, resolve was strong enough, because it did not work.
Your mind was not made up, Craig. That's
exactly.
Probably
exactly.
You're torn between ahimsa and not ahimsa.
Got a long way to go. But this this section where Chris, you know, just read out the beautiful lesson, I rid yourself of mosquito consciousness, you know, is the world going to change for you? It's like he says that in, you know, in jest and kind of a mocking way, rhetorically as well. But we started this section with my early months at Shrikrishwar, with Shrikrishwar culminated in a life, useful life lesson, how to outwit a mosquito. And this is essentially that lesson now, and summarized in one answer, one, you know, five word answer. How do you outwit a mosquito? Rid yourself of mosquito consciousness. And that's the same for, later on, he uses the same thing for illnesses, you know, and he calls it the unwelcome visitor will soon depart. You know, don't acknowledge that you're ill if you're ill, essentially. And this is essentially the same, in the same vein. So is it really talking about the strength of will, the strength that willpower, what impact it can have on you if you really take it to the nth degree? And affirmations, I suppose, as well, because he's really, if you really affirm, like, with all the zeal and zest that you can muster, then it's got to come true, isn't it?
And this is the same Mukunda who appears in visions to his future disciples, and it is the same Mukunda who was able to get the kite from the other roof, right? But here he is in a situation where I'm assuming his guru wants to push a certain message, and so the things have to happen this way.
Mm-hmm. And he goes on to reveal quite a, if it didn't sink in already, this next paragraph really hits home, where he says, you know, meekly he returned to his bed. So maybe he hadn't quite made up his mind yet as well to rid himself of mosquito consciousness. And then he says, interestingly, that not one insect ventured near. And then he realized that the guru, Sri Yukteswar, previously only agreed to the curtains to please him. So very, very kind of Sri Yukteswar to do that. And that he had no fear of mosquitoes, Sri Yukteswar, but to use this yogic power that he could prevent the mosquitoes from biting him, or if he chose, he could simply escape to an inner vulnerability.
Invulnerability,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Before maybe we jump into what do you think this yogic power reference here is, we'll go to Mike for comments.
I was wondering that. I do see the mosquitoes as a way of Maya to get your attention to the outside. Like, if there are no mosquitoes, then there it will find other things. But mosquitoes are a particularly difficult way to, like I said, for example, mosquitoes happened to me when I was trying to meditate outside. It's really part of Maya trying to prevent you from doing that. And that inner vulnerability is like a place where you can go, a place of consciousness, where you can go, where nothing can harm you, where that you can completely forget about the world. And that's one of the goals of Kriya and meditation, right? To get to that place where the world cannot get to you anymore.
When he initially said, meekly I returned to my bed, this was essentially after a chastisement from Sri Yukteswar, right? He didn't say it in a gentle way, did he? Is the world going to change for you? Kind of a mocking, isn't it? But when he, you know, then he obviously practiced it, and then essentially no insect ventured near him. So initially he probably was dubious, but then he actually used the technique that he'd just been given of the affirmation. And the yogic power that I think that Chris refers to in the question, I don't think Sri Yukteswar needs to use affirmations. So he can muster, to use a Star Wars reference, the light side of the Force. You know, you could imagine him just creating a force field around himself, and without even much of a effort, he can do that kind of thing. And then he said, and then the other option says, so Guruji says that, or you could escape to an inner invulnerability, which would imply that you can just keep getting bitten, but he cares not, because even if there's 50 mosquitoes, how much blood are they really going to take? The problem with the problem for us is that I think it's the mosquito saliva, isn't it, that our body reacts to, and then we try and scratch the heck out of it, and it goes red and starts bleeding, or your skin goes sore. But if you don't do those things, if you just let your body deal with the saliva and the poison that's in you, then I'm sure it'll be probably quicker recovery. And that's probably what someone like Sri Yukteswar could allow his body to do, rather than what we do, which is just moan and suffer and scratch away ceaselessly.
I didn't know that. That's good to know. I always knew it was more itchy when I scratched it, but that's good to know. Good info.
Oh, that means you haven't scratched it enough. If you keep scratching, it'll go red, and then you keep scratching, and the skin will go away like a carpet burn. Okay. And then you're like, I've scratched too much. What was I doing?
That's definitely one way of getting rid of the problem. I took this yogic power maybe quite simply to be concentration. Like Yogananda had been putting his attention on the mosquitoes, and that's where the attention, his energy went to, right? So I kind of took this yogic power, as maybe a simplistic way, but to concentration, which is easy to say, again, incredibly hard to do, to master, right? but one day we'll get there. Concentration, I find that, a short quote from Guruji saying that it consists in freeing the attention from distractions. and in focusing on any thought in which one may be interested. Meditation is that special form of concentration which the attention has been liberated from restlessness and is focused in God. Meditation is concentration used to know God. And that really, I thought, sums it up, because mosquitoes are incredibly restless. And if the mind's on that, then the mind's going to be restless as well. So, yeah, there's another part on this, maybe in the Bhagavad Gita, chaps, would you kindly read out? And this is on concentration and how to really develop it.
So there's like five stages to it. And it goes, the first stage is, with newly awakened discrimination, the yogi is able to free his consciousness from the egoistic attachment to his earthly possessions and his little circle of friends. And the second is, though the yogi finds his consciousness free of all external attachments, it still clings tenaciously within to body consciousness when he tries to meditate on God. Experiences of peace and intuitive flashes of the bliss to come encourage him to persevere against the resistance of restlessness and of the ensuing doubts as to whether his efforts are truly worthwhile. Then the third one is, by deep concentration on yoga techniques, the yogi next tries to silence the internal and external body sensations so that his thoughts may focus solely on God.
Fourth, by the right technique of life force control, pranayama, the yogi learns to quiet his breath and his heart. He withdraws his attention and his life energy into the spinal centers. Fifth, when the yogi can quiet his heart at will, he enters super consciousness. The yogi experiences joy and relaxation when it feels in peaceful sleep, the subconscious mind. In the sleep state, the heart still works, pumping blood through the blood vessels while the senses are asleep. When in meditation, the yogi consciously withdraws his attention and energy from his heart, muscles, and senses. These all remain as though asleep, but he has passed beyond the subconscious sleep state of mental awareness into super consciousness.
Yeah, so when I read this, I thought these are really the steps of the evolution of using concentration. And what I thought probably is the steps that Sri Yukteswar was going through quite rapidly, right? So he was able to sink into this quite rapidly. And this is how I imagined it would be when this inner invulnerability, as Guruji described it, he was able to escape to that world. And that's what he's saying to Guruji. And Guruji recognizes that. So he's saying, wow, he's giving me a demonstration here. This yogic state I must strive to attain so that a true yogi is able to pass into and maintain the superconsciousness state, regardless of what's going on around them and the buzz of insects that he refers to here. So the first state of samadhi, so he talks about this being sabbakalpa, and the devotee then being able to shut off the sensory testimony of the outer world. So we can get into this a little bit as well. It's another huge subject. We do have some opportunity to talk about it in the future, so we don't want to go into huge detail here, but maybe Prank, you would be kind enough to give us a reading really from Yogananda. And what is samadhi?
I thought first-hand experience.
No. Or maybe. I'm not allowed to talk about it, right? Sorry. I can't confirm nor deny any such.
All right.
Yeah.
Got it. Yeah.
Mum's the word. Okay. The highest step on the Eightfold Path of Yoga, as outlined by the sage Patanjali, is samadhi, which is attained when the meditator, the process of meditation and the object of meditation become one. Guruji has explained that in the initial states of God communion, sabhi kalpa samadhi, the devotee's consciousness merges in the cosmic spirit. His life force is withdrawn from the body and appears dead or motionless and rigid. The yogi is fully aware of his bodily condition of suspended animation.
As he progresses to higher spiritual states, nirvikalpa samadhi, however, he communes with God without bodily fixation, and in his ordinary waking consciousness, even in the midst of exacting worldly duties, both states are characterized by oneness with the ever new bliss of spirit. But the nirvikalpa state is experienced by only the most highly advanced masters.
Which one do you want, Chris, out of the two?
I'll take either, Rick. I'll not be picky.
You have to be greedy when it comes to spirituality.
Oh yeah, that's true.
Spiritual selfishness.
Yeah.
So go all nirvikalpa, man. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Go ahead, Rick.
Yeah, so I really liked in this section of the autobiography where he actually says he bolsters this narrative or description, and he says he's rewarded then by sounds and scenes of inner realms fairer than the pristine Eden. Really, really nice. An ode to the benefits of the Om technique of meditation, you might say there.
Yeah, and there's a lovely footnote there as well, isn't there? Footnote 6 in this chapter, saying that the omnipresent powers of a yogi, whereby he sees, tastes, smells, touches, and hears without the use of outward sensory organs, have been described as follows. Now, this, what we're going to jump into, is the Aranyaka. Thank you. And this is something I hadn't actually recalled reading this when I first read it. But this description, really, that Guruji's quoting that comes from this is to describe it, really, is it's Vedic commentary that is meant for those already, you know, familiar with the basic hymns and practices and rituals that underpin the Hindu philosophy. So it weaves together captivating stories about the origins of these practices, along with the hidden interpretations of the deeper spiritual significances. So it's divided into a couple parts. What Guruji is referencing here, the first one is really focusing on the intricacies of building and maintaining the sacred fires, whilst the second is, you know, it ventures into more philosophical, metaphysical concepts related to the universe itself. So Guruji is obviously familiar with these texts, these Vedic texts. I read somewhere they're sort of seen as like a bonus on the main scriptures, Vedic scriptures. This is like bonus reading on the rituals, which I thought was quite funny. And there's a quote here on this that Guruji gives us, saying that the blind man pierced the pearl, the fingerless put a thread through it, the necklace wore it, and the tongueless grazed it. So it's a beautiful, beautiful line there that Guruji is referencing. And this is how it's described, really, samadhi for us. And again, this is just so simply put, but you could spend a lifetime studying that, couldn't you? So there it is in its simplicity given to us by Guruji. Priyank?
Yeah, it's very beautiful that this, just this three lines. I'll put a text to the whole Taittiriya, Aranyaka. So Aranyaka actually means produced, born, or relating to a forest. So it's like the belonging to the wilderness, essentially, this text. But this scripture, as Chris said, is part of the Vedic text, but it's like a sub addenda to the Upanishads. So some pretty deep philosophy in there, but lots of rituals and sacrifices and offerings and things like that, and ceremonies, fire ceremonies, kriya ceremonies, things like that are in there.
Yeah, it's quite advanced reading, I think, for, like I said, for people who either are quite familiar with the texts already. So Guruji is obviously one of those beings indeed. And we move on to then the second part of this episode, really, the overcoming desire for destruction. And it's a whole follow-on from the mosquitoes being the lesson that Guruji's learning here is that his guru was interpreting ancient texts one day, and he was sitting at his feet in perfect peace, and then another mosquito comes in and that was kind of vying for his attention, and as it bit into him, Guruji says, as it dug a poisonous hypodermic needle into my thigh, he automatically then raised his hand to avenge this pain that he's, distraction really, that he's experiencing, and was going to kill the mosquito. So the memory actually came to him before Sri Yukteswar jumps in to talk to him, that Patanjali's amorphism on ahimsa sort of popped into his mind. Now, whether actually, guys, now that I read this, thinking out loud, do you think that this was indeed, you know, a unique thought that Guruji had, or do you think Sri Yukteswar was almost planting something in his head prior to saying something to him? Mike?
I find it already needs a very high state of consciousness to just being bit by a mosquito, and then my natural reaction would just be to try to kill it, just as my instinct of self-preservation, the thing bit me, so I kill it, and then saying, oh no, it hurt me a lot just now, but I wanted to live, I don't want to kill it, and just holding back. I find this is already a high state of consciousness to be in. But of course, for Sri Yukteswar, you need to be even one level higher. You shouldn't even have that reaction in the first place.
Have you guys experienced this very thing? For example, whilst meditating, and you can feel, you know, you're getting bit, and you know that it's happening. the dreaded experience is happening. Do you A, get out of your meditation and deal with it, or B, persevere and just let it happen and refocus your gaze up at the Christ Consciousness Center?
Does it mean you're not already in samadhi?
When you're, yeah, that's true. Then you wouldn't have felt it, I'm sure. Or you may not have been aware of the feeling because you've not to put your awareness there. But I'm going to ask you, what did you do last time it happened? Last time it happened to me, I believe, was in India. Where was I? I was in a hotel room and meditating on the floor. And I knew it happened, but I thought, let me finish this 10-minute, because I was doing a 20-minute, 10-minute thing. And I said, let me finish this section of my practice. So I let it happen. And then I opened my eyes and sure enough, the mosquito was still there. I was like, it wasn't just my mind playing tricks on me. I was like, fluffed it away. So I let it happen. What did you guys do, Chris? What did you do when it last happened?
Is this like a confession time or something? I think the last time, I shook violently. Thinking that would be the lesser of two evils, that I actually tried to lift my hands or something, that as if that would be better. Like I was going to shake up my body, trying to get it away from me. But I believe I reached for like a blanket or something, tried to wrap myself in it and, you know, hope for the best.
Yeah, that's what I did in the next 10-minute round.
Yeah.
The next set of techniques.
It is funny because it is an endless issue really in Brazil for me, and not that I'm the one sort of leading this part of the reading. It really speaks to me because it's almost like a daily type challenge, you know. It's like, and maybe we get these challenges over and over and over again until we overcome them. It's like you're going to have to constantly revisit this lesson, you know. So I'm definitely, yeah. I'm probably way back. I'm getting held behind at school on this particular issue for sure. But yeah, I mean, if you've done well, Prank, you know, if you've let it bit you that for that 20 minutes, and you sat there and you saw it still there, and you didn't kill it, good on you, because it is challenging. Mm-hmm. And Shriek Deshwar says here, rather facetiously, he says, you know, why didn't you finish the job? And Guruji sort of falls for it. He says, you know, Master, do you advocate taking life? And then Shriek Deshwar says, no, but in your mind, you'd already struck the death blow.
Boom! That was me. I'd be collapsed.
Yeah.
I'm done.
Yeah, the ego has just had a KO on that one, hasn't it? Yeah, exactly. Guruji's still maybe a bit stunned. He says, I don't understand. And Shriek Deshwar spells it out for him. And this part, obviously, you know, does raise the question, because Guruji says that this memory actually had just come to him, that Patanjali's ahimsa, you know, his morphism came to him just before he actually struck the mosquito. So he was puzzled a little bit by Shriek Deshwar's the way he was saying what he was saying. So sorry, Priyank, I'll let you come in.
Yeah, the first mention of the footnote of ahimsa is just before this, and in the footnote it says, in the presence of a man perfected in ahimsa, which is non-violence, enmity in any creature does not arise. So this is before he when he thinks of it, when he stops himself from striking the mosquito, this philosophy over ahimsa comes to mind.
I'm sure Deshwar goes into detail then. He says that the ahimsa by Patanjali was meaning really the removal of the desire to kill. And Shriek Deshwar really had peered into Yogananda's mental process, as he says, as an open book. So this world, Shriek Deshwar says, is conveniently arranged for a literal practice of ahimsa, on a daily practice almost, in parts of the world, right, with mosquitoes. Mana, as he continues, is compelled to exterminate harmful creatures, but he is not under a similar compulsion to feel anger or animosity. So lots there to unpack, Priyank.
Pretty deep stuff there, isn't there? But let's go to the very basics. Mentioned Patanjali, and Chris, I prepped you for this, so I'm expecting a polished response. Patanjali is referenced in all of our lessons and in the Bhagavad Gita many times. So remember, there's an eightfold Ashtanga yoga, the eightfold path of Patanjali. I'm not going to ask you to name all those, because I know you, Chris, you're going to know all those, of course. But which step would ahimsa fall into out of all those? Easy. It's a really easy question.
Is it dark? Yeah, it's a good question. Spirit, would it be Niyama?
Maybe? Which one?
Or the moral rules, the Yama or Niyama?
Yeah, I'm asking you.
I think Yama. Okay, final answer.
Yeah.
I'm going to say Niyama.
Niyama. Okay, yeah. Mike?
I was going to say the same, yeah. So, I'll now
give you the definition of what Yama and Niyama is. In Hindi, we use the word Niyam. Niyam in Hindi means like a promise. So something that you would do is a Niyam. So which one do you think it would fall into? Yama or Niyama ahimsa?
Oh, so Yama's, I know what they're, the do's and don'ts, right?
Yes. So Niyam is,
so you're saying it's the other way around. You're saying it's the other way around. You're saying the Yamas are the ones you shouldn't do.
Yeah.
Okay.
I would have thought the same thing as Chris. Oh, interesting. Yeah. Well, in that case, maybe it's the Yamas then.
Yes.
So yes.
Goes into...
Okay. Yeah. I knew you were going to throw me a curveball on that one, Greg.
I warned him. Listeners, I warned him. But
it's too simple for... I thought, like, it's too simple for Priyank to ask me what the eight, the eightfold path of yoga is.
You know me too well. Go on. Seeing as you've prepped it, you may as well tell us what the eightfold path is. Go on, without any looking at text.
Yeah, you know me too well. yeah. Well, we actually have a few of them already said, right? We've got samadhi, we've got yama and niyama. And then one that would be maybe easily forgettable, maybe, is the asana side of things, the right posture.
Mm-hmm. Asana.
I think that's quite easily, you know, you easily forget about that. Pranayama, and which is obviously we're very familiar with that. And then the pratyahara, which was mentioned actually really in the readings that we've done, the interiorizing. And then the ones I always forget, which I'm going to have to read, is the dharyana and the dhyana, the other two. So concentration and the meditation.
And the last one is?
The ultimate one is samadhi.
Samadhi, yeah. That's very nice.
Yeah, which we'll talk about the different, breakdowns.
Out of the park. Yeah, like, well, Mike would call that a home run.
Sure.
You've given me enough warning on a prank.
Next time it's gonna be an even more advanced one.
Yeah, I'm already looking forward to it. I was saying I was just gonna pass it off to Mike because Mike's pretty versed in this. So Mike, you were going to get
you hear it a million times at some point, but I don't know if I would have been able. Did you say pratyahara? Because that's one that
pratyahara.
Okay.
Yeah.
But it's easy to forget one or two of them. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Worth studying, which is one of them, right? Which one's the study? Sorry. Dhyana? Is that the one where it's
Dharana, Dhyana, and Samadhi.
Dharana. It is Dhyana. It's referencing this study in part. So Sri Yukteswar's laying it out for him, really, and Guruji's taking in this lesson. So he's getting a couple great lessons here in short time and all around the simple mosquito. And he goes on to say that, you know, after that, we should not really have anger or animosity, is that all forms of life have an equal right to the air of Maya. And that's such a line, isn't it? Really makes you think, like, wow, like, we do take ourselves as the higher beings, really. And, you know, it's quite easy to forget that even the mosquito, the lowly mosquito, has this equal right to the air of Maya. Very powerful line, Priyank.
Yeah. I also wanted to compare this to Gandhi's definition of ahimsa and harmlessness. Again, in chapter 44, you know, it refers it to harmlessness. And Gandhi obviously had a lot of Jain philosophy influence. So Guruji asked him, Mahatmaji, I said, as I squatted beside him on an uncushioned mat, please tell me your definition of ahimsa. And Gandhiji responds, the avoidance of harm to any living creature in thought or deed. Beautiful ideal, but the world will always ask, may one not kill a cobra to protect a child or oneself? And Gandhiji responds, I could not kill a cobra without violating two of my vows, fearlessness and non-killing. I would rather try inwardly to calm the snake by vibrations of love. I cannot possibly lower my standards to suit my circumstances. With his charming candor, he added, I must confess that I could not serenely carry on this conversation were I faced by a cobra. So Gandhi adds a few of his own little vows, doesn't he, into this, for example, fearlessness, which is an interesting take compared to how Sri Yukteswar is essentially describing, and what we're going to talk about is essentially mastering yourself is also in the process of mastering ahimsa, which Chris is going to allude to. But it's an interesting comparison because these are the two big sections where ahimsa is referenced.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I always wonder why two avatars would have a different definition of the same concept. One thing that I think of with Mahatma Gandhi is that he's almost like an incarnation of Ahimsa. That is like one of the prime concepts of his life, and that's why he doesn't want to take away from it in any way, and show that you can live a life where you, at least you give as much Ahimsa as you can. And he doesn't say, I would let my son be killed by the cobra, or daughter. He just says he would find other means to remove the cobra.
I don't really find even though they're described differently, I don't find any contradiction personally. I think that Sri Yukteswar is coming at it purely from a Kriya science perspective, what it means. And Gandhiji, as Mike alluded to, is an incarnation of essentially Ahimsa. And he's literally talking, he's not a Kriya yogi. So he's talking quite practically, both in terms of, he says, both in terms of thought and deed and fearlessness. He brings that into it. Whereas Guruji also, Sri Yukteswar, you know, he starts with saying Patanjali meant the removal of the desire to kill, which is in sync with Gandhi's thought to kill, isn't it? So they are there. You just have to dig a bit deeper. But then Sri Yukteswar really goes deeper, as Chris is going to go into in this paragraph, because he really links it to the Patanjali's, you know, Ashtanga Yoga and basically mastering yourself, and why these yamas and niyamas are in there, and why they're the elementary steps for us to attain or follow before we can reach the higher states.
Before we jump into this, actually, a few paragraphs back, Guruji actually made the observation that it was Sri Yukteswar had no fear of the mosquitoes.
Nice.
So it is there, yeah. It is there.
Nice.
So
it's all succinct.
Yeah, quite right. It's, yeah, it definitely, yeah. And so Sri Yukteswar says a brilliant line that the saint who uncovers the secret of creation will be in harmony with nature's countless bewildering expressions, and all men may understand this truth by overcoming the passion for destruction. And, you know, a million questions probably pop into the mind, but one of them definitely was, what is this secret of creation he's talking about? So we can look at that. But first, Priyanka.
On the first thing he says, though, is that, I don't know if you covered this, is the world is inconveniently arranged for a literal practice of Ahimsa. So for this, I thought he meant, you know, right now I've probably breathed in a trillion microorganisms and destroyed them in my lungs and gut. And also stepping, you know, when you step out on the street and step on an insect unknown to you, and when you're doing gardening, you know, you probably kill hundreds of worms every time you do some gardening and other insects. So, but it doesn't mean that you shouldn't do these things and live a completely solitary and idle life where, like, you can't do any of these things, because we have our destinies and we have our roles to play in this drama, which apparently includes you know, some form of himsa. We can't avoid it, essentially. So that's the first thing that is in here. And then he says that, as Chris said, man may be compelled to exterminate harmful creatures. So then you could do it unconsciously, but sometimes you have to do it consciously. But then he says he is not under a similar compulsion to feel anger or animosity. So you can't, out of anger or animosity, can commit an act of violence to protect yourself, for example. It has to be, you know, with a calm and equipoise state where if, you know, we're going to talk about a bit later, if a cobra is coming to bite you, you don't just let it bite you. Mm-hmm. Or if, you know, a tiger is in the vicinity, you don't just open your neck out and let it do what it needs to do. use force if you have to, and he'll explain why a bit later. But that's the other thing. And the Chris's question was, the saint who uncovers the secret of creation, will be in harmony with nature's countless bewildering expressions. So in that, I read that. So here we've had contradictions, haven't we? Ahimsa is essentially non-killing in thought or deed, but it's something that we should be following. So this kind of like a paradox. But he's saying that saint who uncovers the secret of creation, i.e. resolves this by mastering himself, essentially then will be in harmony with nature's countless bewildering expressions. So that's what I thought. That's what I thought it referred to anyway. And it's beautifully expressed here, isn't it? All forms of life have an equal right to the air of Maya. And it makes it sound so fresh and joyous, but it's obviously not so. We know it's not so.
The reality is constantly itching and
well, suffering, isn't it? Maya, being in this Maya is essentially suffering, isn't it? Being born.
Yeah. It's funny, you know, reading some of the lessons at the moment that I'm on, this was just right on the money for what I was reading. And obviously we can't go into detail of what's in the lessons, but in general, this secret of creation that Sri Yukteswar is referencing here, I took it for something along the lines of that all is one, essentially, that this differentiation that we perceive in this world of Maya isn't the case. So there's a reading in Second Coming, Mike, if you could read out, and this is maybe what closely I thought might describe this, what is this secret that Sri Yukteswar is talking about?
Spirit, being the only existing substance, had not but itself with which to create. Spirit and its universal creation could not be essentially different, for two ever-existing infinite forces would consequently each be absolute, which is by definition an impossibility. An orderly creation requires the duality of creator and created. Thus, spirit first gave rise to a magic delusion, Maya, the cosmic magical measurer, which produces the illusion of dividing a portion of the indivisible infinite into separate finite objects. Even as a calm ocean becomes distorted into individual waves on its surface by the action of a storm, all creation is nothing but spirit, seemingly and temporarily diversified by spirit's creative vibratory activity.
Beautiful. That's taken from the Second Coming, Guruji's words there. And there's something really jumped out at me there when you were reading, Priyank, the passion for destruction. And that's something maybe that we probably don't talk about as much. We don't really focus on this idea, but it's in the hearts or minds of mankind, isn't it? And it might be seen as the opposite of creation itself, you know, God the creator and, you know, the different forces, the positive, negative forces that exist, but it definitely is there. You know, Guruji's showing us that even he raised his hand to avenge the sore that the mosquito had left him. So yeah, it's a really, really good, well put way, right? The passion for destruction that Sri Yukteswar is saying here, Mike.
I feel that this whole concept where creation is this like Maya is something separate from the creator is so fascinating, you know, that essentially we are all one. When you read those kind of sentences, you start thinking about, you know, those very basic questions: who am I and where do I come from? And I really like going into this matter.
I already, it's quite depressing, isn't it, reading this line? All men may understand this truth by overcoming the passion for destruction. As Chris said, it's quite rampant, isn't it? It is quite sad, whether it's on large scale, like war, or on smaller scale, like the joy found in hunting.
Yeah, but I think when we, if we go back to the mosquito, you would, I think there is a reflex in us that would take it personally that the mosquito bites us. We'll go like, this mosquito is here now and he's against me and he tries to take my blood and why? And that's why the reflex then comes, he's my enemy. So it's me against the mosquito. I have to go out and kill him. And maybe that's where passion comes from. And the yogic way is to see this whole as just the interplay of nature and its different parts and not to take it personally and to rise above it.
You know, I've said before, I lived in a canal boat in London and I bought a shell and built it internally. And Barbara and I did not have a clue what we were doing. And we put wood in and we didn't seal it effectively on one side. And we did seal it on the other. And it turned out we had to take the whole thing down. So the whole boat, from ceiling to floor, really was with these wooden strips. And we had to take it all down. And in a way, destroying what we had built was actually, whilst it was painful in one way, mentally did have to do, it's fun. there's a sort of passion in destroying stuff, like, and it, because it's easy as well, like, it's a funny thing just to kind of reflect on, because it is easy to destroy in a sense. It is much more difficult to create. But we should not take the easy path and get lost in that world. And Guruji himself really is perplexed, and he says, you know, to his guru, Sri Yukteswar, Guruji, should one offer himself as a sacrifice rather than kill a wild beast? And to your point, maybe referencing like a tiger or something like this might come to kill you. And Sri Yukteswar answers, he says, no, man's body is precious and it is the highest evolutionary value because of the unique brain and spinal centers. This really would enable the advanced devotee to fully grasp and express the loftiest aspects of divinity. So no lower form is equipped with this. And it is true that man does incur a debt of a minor sin, Sri Yukteswar goes on to say, if he is forced to kill an animal or any other living thing. So maybe a question then, preempt to what you were saying before, like, this, you definitely should not have anger or animosity or something in your heart, but still, from what I read here, that there is still a minor sin incurred if you're forced to kill an animal or any other living thing. So he finishes to say that the holy Shastras teach that any wanton loss of a human body is a serious transgression against the karmic law. And Guruji breathes a sigh of relief that he was able to have this wisdom and knowledge given to him by his guru. So
very nice. Okay. The Sri Yukteswar actually wrote in liaising with Lady Mahashai, he actually wrote a commentary to the Bhagavad Gita, which is not published by SRF, but you can get copies of it. He wasn't able to complete it, but so it's not a complete book, but I'll put a link to what he's completed, half of it, and the rest of it's like extracts from his notebooks and things like that. So you can get, I'll put a link to it. But he, you know, earlier we talked about the Bhagavad Gita verse, chapter 1, verse 1. And if you read God Talks with Arjuna, it's, you know, massive, massive piece of work. Just that first, it's like 30 pages, just the first verse. And it's similarly so in Sri Yukteswar's copy, his own edition or scriptural commentary on this. And he refers to this specific thing about ahimsa and animals, and he's referred to it in this and relating it to the different, as Yogananda does, the different names of the people that are assembled on the battlefield. And so he says it in this section. He says, when ahimsa is manifested, meaning when no meanness ever arises in one's mind, then these types of people have no enmity with anyone. Violent and aggressive animals, such as tigers and bears, remain docile towards these beings. When meanness and aggression are forgotten for life, a beautiful radiance arises, whose qualities of trustworthiness and deep contentment are seen in the eyes of and experienced by even violent and aggressive animals. Thus, not even a hint of aggression arises in their minds. So, really beautiful. So, when you conquer this, essentially, then you need not fear any animal, be it a cobra, or which is we're going to talk about in a little while, or a tiger.
I believe that that's going to be true in the higher ages, where there's going to be much less aggression in people's minds, and then wild animals will also suddenly be less aggressive, and there will be more harmony. So a lot of the aggressiveness that in the world probably originates in men's thoughts and then transpires all over.
Chris, you're muted.
Are you on mute?
Forgive me, sorry. To your point, Brent, earlier on about Mahatma Gandhi and Cobras, we do have our very own story for Sri Yukteswar and a Cobra. And it is a fascinating story, actually. It really stuck with me since reading it for the first time. Because I think these lessons are really best told through stories, in my opinion. You know, it really kind of sinks in. And maybe this is to what Guruji said about change yourself and change the world, you know, change thousands. That through these great examples that we have here, we can actually, imitate them. Caution, I probably wouldn't try this at home with a cobra if you come across one. But Yogananda then says that Sri Yukteswar, as far as he had known, hadn't been close to a leopard or a tiger, but he had come into contact with the cobra and had conquered it with his love. And so he says that there was an encounter that took place in Puri, and it was by the seaside hermitage there, Sri Yukteswar's hermitage, and that a young disciple had of Sri Yukteswar's later years was there with him on the occasion, and was telling the story really to Yogananda. So they were both sitting there. Prafulla is the name. Prafulla is the name of the devotee, and he was saying that sitting outdoors near the ashram. So for me, a cobra is such a faraway thing. You know, you don't get these in the UK, right? But here is a cobra right next to the ashram. So close quarters. And it was 4 foot in length of sheer terror, as it was described. Its hood was angrily expanded, and it was it raced towards both the devotee and Sri Yukteswar. And Sri Yukteswar reacted by giving it a warm, a welcoming chuckle, as though he was a child, as though the cobra was a child, and that he was the devotee was filled with consternation, and Sri Yukteswar engaged really in a rhythmic clapping of his hands. And there's a note here, a footnote 8, and Guruji says that cobras swiftly strike any moving objects within its range, so in most cases, the better thing to do is to stay completely immobile. But here, Sri Yukteswar is doing the opposite. So he's clapping rhythmically. And the devotee then says that it looked like he was entertaining the cobra. Mm. And he chose to remain completely quiet. And inwardly, he was ejaculating fervent prayers for the three of them. So the cobra seems to be very close to Sri Yukteswar, and it was motionless. So I've heard they go into trances if you play maybe music or something like that. I've seen sort of more stereotypical takes on that, whether it's true, I'm not sure. But it was in a some sort of trance. It was motionless, and Sri Yukteswar was clapping to it. and it was magnetized by the caressing attitude of Shrikteshwar. And the frightful hood generally contracted, and the snake slithered between Shrikteshwar's feet and disappeared into the bushes. So danger averted. And there's the question here from the devotee to say that, you know, why Shrikteshwar would really move his hands and why the cobra didn't strike him was inexplicable to him then. But since he came to realize that the divine guru was beyond fear, there's that comment again, of hurt from any creature. So, yeah, beautiful, beautiful story, really, isn't it, Priyanka?
Wonderful story. And you can really visualize it, can't you? Even though we've got such little footage of Sri Yukteswar, we haven't got any of his voice or at all or anything, but you can just hear his laughter in this. You can hear his chuckle. You can hear him clapping his hands. You can see him smiling and just being completely fearless, as he, you know, quoted in chapter 1, verse 1 of his own commentary of the Bhagavad Gita that I read out previously. So it's really, really lovely to just visualize this episode, because you can with this such a beautiful narrative. So it would mean that if you do master yourself, then essentially mosquitoes, tigers, and snakes will no longer have any any interest in you whatsoever, which is quite a cool concept. So there's also a nice section in Mejda, actually, and this was of Mukunda even meeting Sri Yukteswar. His brother says that one evening we went to call Mejda from his meditation at Dakshineshwar temple near under the Panchavati tree, as it was time for the aarti. Aarti is the devotional offering to the deity with the candles and the flame. So he says the quiet event had wrapped Mejda's attention. His meditation nook in the deep shadows, so he was engrossed in meditation. As we approached, we saw a halo of soft light encircling Mejda's body. This is why I was saying, remember the Star Wars reference to the Force. He says a snake had coiled itself around his neck. Another lay on his lap. The scene immobilized us for a moment. Then I called out, "Mejda, Mejda." When at first he didn't respond, Manmohan and Jitendra also called him. In a few moments, Mejda stirred slightly. Then he gently clapped his hands and the snakes slipped away quietly into the dense underbrush surrounding the tree. When we mentioned the incident to Mejda later, he spoke lightly about it, saying it was nothing.
Yeah.
I've read that snakes are, especially cobras, energy-wise, they're quite attracted to yogis and meditators. So
I was just going to say that, yeah. And they're somehow easier to be influenced with the energy, yeah.
Yeah, and it's said that because they're so sensitive, the snake, that maybe angels or, you know, high beings in other planes would actually embody the snake at times. So there's lots on that, isn't there? On the humble snake, let's say.
So Shiva has a snake wrapped around his body, doesn't he?
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. Lots of symbolism that we could delve into, but we shall not. that would conclude this episode, really, and this part of the chapter 12. And hopefully we've done it justice. I know there's a lot in there to try to unpack for folks. I don't know, did we miss anything, guys? Any additional points that you want to discuss before we call it a day for today?
It's all good.
All good stuff. Well, next time, Lauren, hopefully will be with us. Mike will be leading the next part. I'll do a quick recap to start us off if the readers like the little recaps. as our listeners like the recaps. And until then, thanks for tuning in. Jai Guru.
Jai Guru.
Jai Guru.